Live from the state capitol in Augusta, this is Maine Calling. The Maine legislature is back in session dealing with last-minute legislation and a record number of vetoes from Republican Governor Paul LePage. LePage has vetoed 72 bills this session, a total of 179 since taking office 4 years ago. That's more than any other governor in recent history. One of the measures targeted by LePage is a widely supported plan to close a $32 million hole in the state budget. I'm Keith Shortall. Today on the program, we'll talk with our regular contributors to Across the Aisle, our weekly segment on Maine politics from Maine Things Considered, and with Dick Woodbury, an independent state senator from Yarmouth. We'll look at the goings-on today at the Statehouse and at some of the races on the ballot this year in Maine, and of course, we want to hear from you. Maine Calling, live from the state capitol in Augusta. First, this news. From the MPBN studios in Augusta, I'm Keith Shortall, and this is Maine Calling. It's a busy day here in Augusta. The legislature is in hyper gear, responding to a spate of vetoes issued by Governor Paul LePage. My guest today will offer insights onto what's really going on here today and how all of this action here at the Capitol may impact the race for governor. We'll also touch on some of the other races in the state this year. Joining me in our Augusta studio today, Cynthia Dill. She's a practicing attorney and former Democratic state senator. Dan DeMeritt, he's a political consultant and former communications director for Governor Paul LePage. Also joining us, Dick Woodbury. He's an economist and independent Maine state senator from Yarmouth. We invite you to join the conversation. What do you think of this soon-to-be-concluded legislative session? The number 1-800-399-3566. That's 800-399-3566. Email talk@mpbn.net. You can tweet at Maine Calling or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. And for continued coverage of the legislature as it works to wrap up its business, don't forget about MPBN Television's Maine Capitol Connection channel. It'll cover both the Maine House and the Senate today. Maine Capitol Connection. It's available over the air and on the digital tier of most Maine cable companies. For information about the channel, you can visit mpbn.net. And Cynthia is taking pictures here at the table.
I can't help it. It's so exciting.
My shirt.
Anyway,
well,
welcome to all of you. Dick Woodbury, let's start with you. You've been in the thick of this action this morning with votes reacting to vetoes. What's been going on?
Well, let me give you a general sense of where we are. The legislature basically finished its work 2 weeks ago, and the governor has 10 days in which to veto bills that have been passed. So there's a flurry of activity near the end of the session that ended 2 weeks ago. And we're here today for what is affectionately known as Veto Day. And we're looking at 48 bills that the governor has vetoed. 14 of them are bills that originated in the Senate. So the Senate is looking at those 14 vetoes first. And then 34 bills originated in the House. So the House is looking at those 34 bills. So we've started in this morning as sort of going through the list of the bills. I can talk about the Senate side. On the Senate side, we've had votes on 12 so far, six of which were overridden, and six of which the veto was sustained. And some of the bills are pretty weighty bills. The three that I'd mention in particular, the budget for fiscal year 2015 is a vote that was unanimously passed by the Appropriations Committee on a bipartisan basis. The governor vetoed it. It has now been overridden in both the House and the Senate. So that's a, you know, one of the more weighty measures that we're dealing with today.
So that was not a big surprise because it had already been kind of hammered out and agreed upon.
It was not a surprise, but nothing's a sure thing until it happens either. But as you know, politics can change very quickly. But you're right. It has now been overridden.
So there was that. What about there? And then you said there were three. Were there two others?
So, I mean, you may remember at the end of the last session, there was a research and development bond bill that the governor vetoed and was not overridden. The veto was sustained. And many thought that that was the kind of bill that is really important for what Maine's economic future ought to look like. There's a comparable bill that came out this session that provides funding for loan guarantees and loans for business development type projects. It's a bond issue to capitalize this loan program. Again, very strongly supported in the legislature and vetoed by the governor. But this time, it was overridden in the Senate so far on, I think, a 31-4 vote, so a very strong vote. And I don't know yet what will happen in the House.
And in this case, this was a question of the governor just saying if I recollect his letter, it was something about, in principle, he supported but didn't like the going to the taxpayers, I guess, to fund a revolving loan fund.
Yeah, I think there's always a question with bond issues as to whether the thing that you are funding is something that you ought to pay out of bond money, which gets paid back over the long-term future, or whether it's something that you ought to pay for out of the current budget. And I think that's a fair debate to have. But, you know, the key thing is that this is the kind of, these programs are the kind of programs we want to have funded because they really are, in my judgment, really are important to Maine's future economy. And a bond issue is a perfectly reasonable way to pay for it because the benefits of what you're funding are, in fact, going to accrue over some future period. So there's a logic to it.
Okay. So we had the budget, we had this measure, and was there a third?
Well, the third weighty one that I was going to mention, and this, of course, is no surprise either, but there are two Medicaid expansion bills that are still, you know, out there that were passed by largely partisan votes, not completely partisan votes, but largely partisan votes. The governor vetoed both of those Medicaid expansion bills, and at least the one on the Senate side, the veto was sustained on not a pure party line vote, but very close.
Right. Let's bring in Cynthia and Dan. Let's go to Dan first. Dan, you have here Republicans who are really faced in some of these cases with a choice here to either go with the governor, their fellow Republican, or take a different route in the case of the budget and with some of these others that they are agreeing to override. What does that decision hinge upon? The upcoming election or philosophical differences?
I think it's coming down mostly to philosophical differences, and it seems like the members in both chambers on the Republican side are voting their conscience a great deal, and at sometimes that'll put them at odds with the governor's veto, and they'll vote to override. Other times they'll sustain it; they'll vote to sustain based on where their personal beliefs are and you know, the needs of their districts. What's interesting is when you see members flip. You know, members who were in favor of passage. As legislation proceeded through the House or Senate the first time, and then because the governor vetoed it, or you know, after the governor's action, their vote changes. You know, I believe there were five members seeing this morning in the back and forth, five members in the Senate, for instance, who flipped on the food hub bill, in the Senate. They favored it originally, and then they voted to sustain the governor's veto when it came back through. Those are things where members put themselves perhaps in some political jeopardy to stand with the governor. Because they're going to be questioned, you know, why were you for it before and are now against it? And if it's purely political, purely to have the governor's back on an issue, well, that could be a problem, and that could come back to bite them in an election.
And Cynthia, you were in the Maine Senate, different scenario when you were there. But did you ever witness this kind of pattern where there's this veto day and a lot of vetoes and then the legislature scrambles in a day to deal with so many of them? Or did that not happen when you were here?
Never in the history of Maine has there been 182 vetoes. The most, the largest number, of course, was under Governor Longley's tenure when he had 118. When I was in the Senate, we certainly had veto day, but I think it definitely was different. This strikes me as more of a campaign stunt on the part of the governor, trying to make himself relevant in a process that he's largely stepped aside from. For instance, he didn't participate at all in the budget bill. He largely has been missing. I mean, he's been Morocco. Apparently doesn't really have a a sense of what's happening in other areas of state government, like the National Guard. So, I mean, I think he's just trying to draw attention to himself and make himself relevant and sort of kick his campaign off with a bold statement about, you know, him drawing a line in the sand and kind of sending a message that really isn't about the policy but more about the person.
Dick Woodbury, the governor did come under criticism from Democrats who said, hey, look, you asked us to fix this budget problem. You said it was our problem. We did it, and now at the end you say you don't like it, even though it had a pretty strong support in both houses from both parties. What's he doing there, do you think?
Well, I largely agree with Cynthia that there's a lot of, I guess, political groundwork happening leading up to the governor's race, and people are trying to get their messages in place and so forth. So, you know, that's not just on the Republican side or the governor's side. That's happening on the Democratic side to some degree, too. What I'd say is different about this session than anyone I've seen, you know, since I've been involved, is that it's a divided government session, in that throughout the Baldacci years, we had a Democratic legislature and a Democratic governor, so that within the Democratic Party, policy decisions could get made and advanced. The same was true in the first 2 years of Governor LePage's term. You had a Republican majority legislature and a Republican governor. So the Republican Party could largely advance the agenda that it thought that it should. You know, in this case, you've in a sense got veto power on both sides. So that leads to, I think, more bills that are put forward as what I'll call statement bills. And it becomes a little more difficult, and I guess I'd say particularly with this governor, to advance things in more collaborative ways.
Yeah. Dan, is this really about the election, all this activity, the late night, the gavel? It sounds like a construction site up in under the dome there. Is this about politics, or is it about governance and moving legislation forward that helps the people of Maine?
I think it's about governance not working as it should. In some of these cases, the chief executive, the governor, needs to work with the legislature to, you know, typically as it's traditionally been occurred or as it's expected to occur, the chief executive will work with the legislature, things will get worked out, and the veto is, you know, a kind of a last resort negotiation tool or, you know, something to stop a piece of legislation from moving forward where it truly just it was a breakdown and an agreement could not be reached. In this case, particularly the bills where there was strong bipartisan support, like the budget bill, like the DUI, strengthening the penalties or the rules around drunk driving, those kinds of bills where they got strong support from both sides of the aisle are an example where the governor came out and vetoed them, where the process is broken down and there should have been discussions ahead of time, you know, issues worked out, and then, you know, a bill could go forward that could get legislative support and the governor's support. Really, it takes a lot of hard work. I mean, I've never been a legislator like our other two panelists, but I know there's been it takes a lot of hard work to get a bill passed. And my concern from the governor's perspective is when he vetoes one of these bills kind of out of nowhere, that hard work becomes hard feelings for constituencies that the governor needs as part of his coalition for reelection.
Cynthia, should these have been worked out rather than having this veto process play out?
Well, sure. I mean, every bill starts with a legislative hearing, and the governor has an opportunity to send a representative to express his views on the particular piece of legislation and join in, you know, with stakeholder discussions and help craft legislation that ultimately comes out of committee to the floor of the House or Senate. And in large part, the governor has refused to send representatives and has willingly just avoided any kind of discussion about policy until the very end, and then at the end make such a strong statement, like, for instance, in one particular bill, which it has to do with women's health. He said in his veto letter that, you know, after vetoing a bill that would provide low-income women with family planning services that would save money in the long term, prevent unwanted pregnancies, do a lot of really good things for a large majority of low-income women in the state, he says in his veto letter, for those individuals who intend to make less than 100% of the federal poverty level, suggesting that even women's health now is about welfare for people who are, you know, purposely avoiding work and taking personal responsibility. So, I mean, this has been, I think, a real circus here in Augusta, unlike anything I've seen. And I really applaud those legislators like Senator Woodbury, who's been here day in and day out, away from their families, trying to solve problems, only to really be met with a stone wall and a campaign stunt.
Dick Woodbury, we've got about a minute before break, but you wanted to jump in.
Well, when I came into this session as the first one that was a divided session for me, it seemed to me that there were three possible things that could happen. The worst version was a version that was basically gridlock, which, you know, Washington's a pretty good demonstration of gridlock, where you just can't get anything done. The second possibility, which was my dream, was that this created the power dynamic in which the two sides would collaborate and really work on advancing policy in productive ways. And, you know, I don't think that's, you know, collaboration is not exactly the governor's DNA. That doesn't seem to have been the one that happened. The third possibility was that the legislature kept government open while waiting for the next political dynamic, whatever it may be, as in after the next elections. And there's where I give a lot of credit to the Appropriations Committee for having kept government open and running, passing budgets unanimously in a bipartisan way so that we could move on.
All right. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we want to hear from you. The number to join the conversation, 1-800-399-3566. That's 800-399-3566. This is Maine Calling. Stay with us.
You make Maine Calling possible, as does Silly's in Portland's East End. Open at 11 Tuesday through Friday and at 9 for brunch on the weekends with vegan and gluten-free options, sillys.com.
A lawyer uses zoning laws in upstate New York to take on the gas industry and fracking with a simple message.
There's no place in our community where this is appropriate, and you're not allowed to do this at all in our town. No fracking way.
Her initiative is winning and wins her the Goldman Prize. I'm Steve Kerwood, and that's next time on Living on Earth from PRI.
Tune in for Living on Earth, Sunday morning at 7 a.m. Today is either called Override Day or Sustain Day at the state legislature in Augusta, and MPBN Television's Maine Capital Connection channel will cover both the Maine House and Senate today, live whenever possible, as the legislature considers over three dozen bills vetoed by Governor Paul LePage to see if those vetoes will be overridden or sustained. The Maine Capital Connection channel, which will conclude its coverage of the current legislative session this Sunday, is available over the air and on the digital tier of many of Maine's cable companies. For information about the channel, you can visit mpbn.net or you can call MPBN Audience Services at 800-884-1717.
And welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Keith Shortall. Today on the program, the latest news out of Augusta. With me in our Augusta studio, Cynthia Dill, practicing attorney and former Democratic state senator. Dan DeMeritt, a political consultant and former communications director for Governor Paul LePage. And Dick Woodbury, an economist and Maine state senator and independent. We invite you to join the conversation. The number 800-399-3566. That's 800-399-3566. Email talk at mpbn.net, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. And again, for continuing coverage of the legislative activity today, tune in to MPBN Television's Maine Capital Connection channel. So, Dick, how much you are not running for re-election. And so you can talk openly about this. How much does it matter what the sustain versus override numbers are for Governor LePage, in your view, or for the Democrats? Are people paying close attention to that count, like Olympic gold medals, or is that not a big deal?
I think it's less the specific count and more the feel that each side's trying to create with this. And so I think on the Democratic side, there'll be an attempt to portray the governor as an impediment to good progress on good bills, and I think on the governor's side there'll be an intent to portray this as You know, somebody's got to make the tough decisions and I'm doing it. So I think it's more that general feel than it is the specific votes on a specific bill.
And Dan?
I agree. I think, you know, there's a lot of process that goes on here that, you know, a lot of regular, you know, kind of regularly engaged voters aren't going to follow closely, but it will be kind of the feel of it. I do think, however, and I think this plays out in terms of building the coalition that you need for reelection and raising money and things like that, that this stud there, people who do pay attention, and those are the groups that provide money. They provide boots on the ground for political campaigns, and to the extent that you know, those groups are affected by the string of vetoes that we've seen here and all the work that's been kind of sidelined by the governor, you know, I think that will have repercussions.
Cynthia?
Well, I largely agree that I don't think people are going to be keeping score necessarily, but so much work does go into the passage of a bill, and a lot of times a bill is sort of the rallying cry for large coalitions. And I get back to this, Vote for Women's Health. I mean, a lot of work went into passing this bill, bringing people together, physicians, economists, women's groups. So many constituencies have a stake in this bill. And so if the veto is overridden, I think that will be a rallying cry. And if it's sustained, I think it is going to be an important message on a lot of palm cards and a lot of campaign literature, because it's a statement not just about this particular bill, but about the governor's feelings towards women's health and just government process and the role of government altogether.
800-399-3566 to join the conversation. 800-399-3566. We're live at the State House covering the marathon session of the legislature today as it tries to wrap up business for this session. Dick Woodbury, there are examples among these vetoes where the governor supported the sort of the idea of it, but in some cases said it didn't go far enough, so he rejected or he vetoed it, even though he agreed with it. I think there was a welfare fraud initiative, and he said, if the legislature really wanted to get serious about welfare fraud, you know, they'd go further.
Yes.
And so he vetoed it. Isn't that unusual to veto something that even if it's a step closer to what you want?
Well, it is, and I guess that does come back to these vetoes being in part opportunities to make statements about something. I actually, one of my bills this session, the governor vetoed. It was overwhelmingly overridden. And his veto, it was about healthcare price transparency and requiring providers to provide more information about prices to patients. And the veto letter was, this doesn't go far enough. And I said, I agree with you, governor, it doesn't go far enough, but this is what we were able to do. So we overrode it and proceeded on. But you're right. It's an interesting characteristic of some of these vetoes.
And that's because it becomes a story, and there's a story in the paper or on the radio about it, and it becomes sort of reignites the argument in the last minutes of the session.
Sure.
The governor is certainly not one to declare victory and move on. And that's kind of always been, you know, one of the challenges that he'll face when he, you know, As an elected official, it is outside the norm. You know, from some political figures, a grant that gets a fire truck is a big deal, and you know, it's promoted and it's news. And the governor's not that way. The governor sees the glass as half empty all the time, and he's not one to celebrate something that he doesn't see as a real. I mean, even like the hospital debt stuff, his biggest accomplishment, or so he says. You know, he didn't do the kind of rollout that he could have done, you know, with that kind of legislative accomplishment. And, you know, it's kind of, I'm sorry that it bites you, Senator, sometimes, but, you know, it's the way he is. It's part of who he is as a person, I think. And he's just not one to, I mean, when I worked for him, it was a source of frustration where we would not take the easy layup, you know, in terms of messaging and things like that. And then it's just not in his DNA. And that a lot of people love that about him. And it can be admirable, but it also can stop policy that is incremental but important for moving forward.
The governor has also introduced some 11th-hour bills here in this session, which we'll get to in a moment. But I do want to go to the phones to Caribou, and I think it's Sam. Hi, Sam.
How are you?
Good, thanks. Go ahead, please.
I was just wondering what was happening with LD 1431.
Okay, I'm not sure I have the list in front of me. Can you tell us what it does?
That is the farm-to-school program.
Yeah. So LD 1431 is providing grant funding to support the development of local food hubs to help with the distribution of foods that are produced locally. And so this was a Senate bill that did come to the Senate this morning, and it was overridden in the Senate 30-5. And at that point needs to also go to the House, and we don't
know when it's going to go to the House.
There could
have been action while we're on the air. We're not sure.
That could be. Probably not.
Probably
the House
not.
Has a big agenda of its own before it gets to our agenda. But
sure, and there's lunch, and you know, it's a lot to fit in.
I'm sure they're listening to us right now, though, actually. Everything is – no, well, no, everything hasn't stopped, but they should.
Yeah. So I guess, Sam, that's what we know. Are you a supporter of this?
Oh, most definitely.
Yeah, and just tell us why.
Well, it's no big secret up here in northern Maine. I've got a little blueberry farm, and we do a lot of the farm-to-school sales as it is, and this would enhance, no question it would help my farm. But it would also create jobs in Aroostook County because that would allow a lot of us to expand, and that's just another market we could get into.
I just think this is a perfect example of kind of the two sides of Paula Page. On the one hand, he touts himself as a business executive making decisions based on the numbers and, you know, thinking like a businessman. On the other hand, you know, here's Sam talking about how this bill would be great for business in northern Maine. It's an agriculture-based bill that would feed kids blueberries. I mean, you just can't get more wholesome and small business than that, and yet the governor vetoes it. And there's a series of bills that just don't make economic sense. The bond bill, for instance, that he vetoed. Here we are, unprecedented low interest rates. Maine has a healthy bond rating. We're in desperate need of infrastructure. Bonds go out to the voters, and so there'll be, you know, support and, you know, stamp of approval by the voters, and yet the governor vetoes it. So I think, on the one hand, he suggests that he's a business person with business acumen, but the numbers here and these vetoes really, I think, tell a different story.
Yeah, it's interesting his veto message, though, too. I think there's a sense that, you know, we legislators are trying to fix every single problem out there rather than letting things bubble up more within their own communities. So I think what his message suggested was that what he didn't like about this was that it was being prescribed as an approach, that it was forcing the communities to do something they might or they might not want to do, and that if they wanted to do this, they could. Now, having said that, I think government actually should be there to promote things that are good and advance things that are positive. So, you know, I supported this bill, and I supported overriding the veto. But I understand that tension that's described in his letter.
What are some of the other themes we've seen? Fiscal prudence, not adding taxes, any more tax burdens, not adding fees, not adding new restrictions, new regulations. Are there any other sort of themes that apply to the types of bills that the governor doesn't like, Dan?
Governor doesn't seem to like bills that tell him and his administration what to do in terms of being the chief executive of the state. You know, if the legislature, oftentimes the start of a process for looking at an issue is a study or, you know, something, or compelling an agency to provide some kind of report, the governor likes to bat those back pretty regularly.
And I was going to suggest that anything that's even tangentially related to the Affordable Care Act or has to do with health care, he seems to clearly reject. He's definitely not doing anything to help at the national level, the Democrats attempt to successfully roll out the Affordable Care Act and President Obama's attempts to really shore up those numbers and get people, you know, hooked on Obamacare.
And the governor said early on, I think the quote was something like, he's not going to lift a finger to advance the Affordable Care Act. How much of that is his ideological disdain for the notion of the Affordable Care Act, or is politics? This is one of his big themes. Is it going to be a big theme in his campaign? He's against the Affordable Care Act. He's out to stop welfare fraud. There's going to be a short list of things that we're going to hear about, right, Dan, over and over again before November?
Yeah, that's exactly what will happen. And this is, I think it definitely is a philosophical difference with the governor and the Affordable Care Act and, you know, his concerns about, as someone who, you know, has risen from poverty into the position he's in now, and had a lot of success in his life. But I think there's a lot of politics involved in this too, because the thing about welfare and welfare fraud is that it's something everyone has some sort of understanding of. It's not a complex issue. You know, are people getting something they shouldn't get? You know, are people getting over on the system? Everyone is, you know, knows somebody who, you know, where they, who allegedly can't work but can snowmobile all day. You know, we all have those kind of the stories, and whether they're true, whether they're accurate, you know, but it's on a personal level. People get it, and it works for the governor. It's something that he can be passionate about, and he's, you know, he's great. When he's got that kind of passion, he can really has a way to make connections with people in terms of issues they understand.
And that speaks to his core support, Dick Woodbury?
Well, you know, whether you like the Affordable Care Act or not, everybody would agree we're in a period of substantial evolution in health policy in the country. And Maine's got to figure out where it's going to fit into that evolution of health policy. And, you know, when I said I saw divided government as a potential opportunity here, health policy is one of the biggest places I saw it, because, you know, we've had trouble over a long time paying for a very expensive health care system. We've got a lot of low-income Maine residents, and we've got a lot of small businesses that aren't employed by somebody who's giving them health insurance. So we got to figure out how we're going to be providing health care to these people. And for the first time ever, as a result of the Affordable Care Act, we had an opportunity to have a affordable health insurance product for people in any economic circumstance. And some of that sort of was the sort of up to 133% of poverty was Medicaid. Between 133% and 400% was the exchanges. And above 400%, people are considered to be well off, well enough off to buy their own care. But wherever you are in the spectrum, we, for the first time in Maine, had a chance to have a product that was affordable to anybody. So I thought this was a great opportunity for a place like Maine in particular. And if we had been able to work in a collaborative way, I think we might have ended up like some of the states that have figured out how to make their Medicaid programs more private sector managed. So I thought there were great opportunities to find middle ground and actually solve a problem we needed to solve.
So we've got about a minute before break here. But so how does this play out in the governor's race, the Affordable Care Act? You've got the LePage supporters who don't like it and never will like it, and that's very clear. Dick Woodbury, you're a Cutler supporter, we should say, probably. Is that fair to say?
I am.
Okay. How does this play out then between Mike Michaud and Elliot Cutler on the Affordable Care Act? Do they fight over the rest of the people who support it, or are there nuanced differences?
Well, you know, both of them, I think, are generally supportive of the aims of the Affordable Care Act. You know, I think, you know, what distinguishes Elliot Cutler in an important way is his ability to really think, you know, objectively and broadly about and substantively how to address things in the best way possible. I think it's much more difficult for you know, politicians who are linked to political parties and the interest groups that generally support political parties to have that degree of independent thinking. So I think, you know, in many policy areas, this is a potential asset.
I know that Cynthia wants to respond, and maybe Dan does too, but my producer is pushing me. We need to take a quick break. We'll go to Cynthia when we come back, and we want to hear from you as well. 1-800-399-3566. This is Maine Calling. Stay with us.
You make Maine Calling possible, as does Sweetser. Seeking mentors for children with mental and behavioral health needs, learn more at sweetser.org.
I was an orphan. I grew up in Pennsylvania in a whorehouse.
Don Draper told the truth about his background at a pitch meeting on last season's Mad Men and is facing the consequences. On the next Fresh Air, we talk about the current and final season with the show's creator, Matthew Weiner. Join us.
Join us for Fresh Air this evening at 7 o'clock. And join us this afternoon at 1 o'clock following Maine Calling for Ideas from the CBC. Physicist Vandana Shiva, in a lecture presented at the Canadian Museum for Human Rights, explores how Earth rights are human rights from the lecture series Fragile Freedoms, The Global Struggle for Human Rights. That's Ideas from the CBC following Maine Calling at 1 o'clock here on MPBN Radio.
And welcome back. I'm Keith Shortall. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, we're at the State House live in our Augusta studio. Cynthia Dill, a practicing attorney and former Democratic state senator. Dan DeMeritt, political consultant and former communications director for Governor Paul LePage. And Dick Woodbury, an economist and independent Maine state senator. We'd like you to join the conversation as well. The number, of course, 800-399-3566. That's 800-399-3566. Email talk@mpbn.net, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. Before the break, Dick Woodbury was saying, Cynthia, that unlike these party candidates who are beholden to special interests with respect to the Affordable Care Act, independents like Elliot Cutler have an advantage in that because they are sort of unfettered by this influence. And you wanted to respond.
Well, I think that, Governor LePage campaigned initially on a similar theme that, hey, look, I'm not a career politician, I'm a businessman, and I'm going to get to Augusta and make the smart decisions that are in the best interest of the economy. Well, clearly, being a good businessman doesn't translate necessarily into being a good leader or a good politician. And we do have policy and politics in Augusta. In an ideal world, the most qualified candidate would win. We'd have the smartest policies. But what we see is we need somebody who's going to be able to bring people together. And I think Elliot Cutler, we don't know what his record is. He has no record of voting on anything or bringing people together or working with divided government. So I reject the idea that because you're from a party, you can't be objective, you can't have broad thoughts, and you can't collaborate on, smart policy. Because I think, Dick, as you and I shared a number of similar votes when we were in the Maine Senate, and I was not beholden to any special interests, and I don't think Mike Michaud or Governor LePage, for that matter, is beholden to special interests.
But I have to say, Cynthia, you are one of the more independent Democrats.
Yeah, well, I...
Dan, you're silent on this.
Susan Collins is pretty great, too. I have to – Cynthia teases me for, the plugs. And,
yeah, well.
In terms of coming together and, putting party interests aside, there are – and you can certainly argue that Paul LePage marches to his own beat and or his own drum. And, what we get from that is open to interpretation. But, I think that there are philosophical points of view that, all the candidates will have. But I think they are all able to work towards solutions and what they see best.
Let's bring in some of the callers now. Let's go to Orono and Steve. Hi, Steve.
Hey, how you doing?
Good. How are you doing?
I just want to tell Mr. Woodbury that was a great response to that. I'm sure she's an independent Democrat. Of course, they could always vote for L.A. Cutler, which I am. And I disagree. I'm 58 years old. I think that both parties have just, they can agree on something, but there's no leadership to get anything done, in my opinion. I think everybody has done a great job. They have sincere hearts. They have the Maine people at heart. But the reality is you can't blame everything on the governor, and I blame it on the parties, in that at the end of the day, they're both pandering to their extreme base, which is, i.e. the platform of the Maine GOP. For example, in the race up here in Bangor, Kerry Weston is for that platform. Kevin Ray isn't on board with the Maine GOP platform, and they're probably two of the most viable candidates for their race to win, but they're too moderate. And I think it's the same with the Democrats, too, is that, if you can't catch a Democrat publicly saying that they're working with the governor, because that's a kiss of death in your party. I think the parties have outlived their usefulness. It's totally baloney that each candidate from the major parties are not, they're not controlled in some way, whether it's money or ideology. And I'm tired of it. I'm tired of it as a voter. I'm voting for Elliot Cutler. I think he's independent, and he will be. And that's why Angus King won. And but that's my take on it. So.
Okay, Steve, I think there are a number of Mainers who share your beliefs, but Cynthia does not.
Well, I guess what I would suggest to Steve and others who are disappointed or feel that the two-party system isn't perfect is take a broader view of the world and look at every other form of government. And while the two-party system isn't perfect, it's head and shoulders above other types of, you know, political organization, and we've defeated so many challenges, whether it be civil rights, the Civil War. We have the most vibrant economy. We are a place where, you know, women have more rights. We have good regulations when it comes to the environment. So I guess what I would like to see in people like Senator Woodbury, Elliot Cutler, is rather than step outside the system, but work within and perhaps provide some of the leadership that maybe these parties need.
He mentioned Kevin Ray, and we did say we would talk about the second district primary. There are two party primaries, the Democrats and Republicans. Dan, to you, there are real choices in both of those cases. So in the case of Bruce Poliquin versus Kevin Ray, Republicans will have a real choice there, right, in terms of their ideology and who they want to get behind.
Yeah, it's almost night and day in terms of, you know, ideology. They both have some adherence to kind of general Republican philosophy and principles. But I guess the more night and day question for me is, you know, temperament and approach to governing. You've got, you know, Kevin Ray, who's governed, and he's been a key aide to Senator Olympia Snow for a long time, who held that seat. And it's kind of in the mold of the Republicans who've won that seat in the past. And then you have Bruce Poliquin, who is new to government, would be, you know, elected for the first time if he were to win, served as state treasurer, is certainly someone who is, Bruce, if you're listening, I mean this in the best of ways, an agitator. You know, he's one who point, you know, who call out government for its failings and elected officials for its failings. And he his approach is much different than Kevin's. So it'll be really, you know, people have a really stark choice just in personalities. And it'll be really interesting to see what the second district does.
On the Democratic side, Cynthia, is there a choice there?
Oh, clearly, yes. I would say the demarcation between Senator Jackson and Senator Kane is... Senator Troy Jackson and Senator Emily Kane. Very, very different. Troy has a very compelling personal story. He's a logger. He speaks very passionately about workers' rights, and he really fights for what he believes, and he's very principled. Emily Kane, I think, you know, has been in politics since she's been a young woman. She I think is more of a collaborator and has a track record of working across the aisle and brings to the table passion about different things, women's issues. She's been endorsed by Emily's List. So I think the Democratic voters definitely have a really good choice. Two people who, like as Dan said, adhere generally to the Democratic principles, but have sort of define themselves differently with different issues. Both very qualified.
From Twitter, your guest claims we all have stories about welfare cheats. Not true. Everyone's brother's friend's neighbor has heard one. Let's go to Mariah in Bath. It's probably Mariah Holt, is it not? The former legislator?
Yes.
Hi, well, Mariah. Welcome
so
to Main Calling.
I'm grateful to hear that wonderful woman who just spoke to us. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
I'm a little concerned about people's care, concern about our new candidate for governor. You know, he worked so hard over the many years for all the things you talk about, you especially. And I just want you to, you know, think about this usurper that I call him, that who comes in and wants to be governor, but he's not done much for us. Mike has done so much for us. I just would
Mike
like
Michu.
To remind you, okay?
Yeah. Yeah, good.
I mean, Mariah raises a really good point, and that is, for those of people who don't remember, when Mike Michaud was in the state Senate, there was divided government, and he, along with Rick Bennett, who's now the chair of the Republican Party, handled it beautifully. It's a perfect example of collaboration, a track record of collaboration. And so, you know, this idea that because he's a Democrat, he can't work with others, I think, is it just doesn't stand up to the facts and the history in his particular case.
Just back to the second district a little bit, Dan. The conventional historical take on the second district was it was conservative. It was a libertarian streak. It was a gun loving place. It was about freedom of access to land. Has the profile of the voter in the second district changed at all in the last 5 or 10 years to change the dynamics of the kinds of races we might see or outcomes we might see?
I think the second district, I mean, it's a vast place. I think it's the biggest congressional district east of the Mississippi River. It's a rugged place. But I think that those voters are perfectly willing to cross party, and they've been represented by Democrats, moderate Republicans. And, you know, despite their, you know, despite the ruggedness and kind of that image you have for the second district, they're perfectly willing to vote for a Democrat. You know, they've been represented by Mike Michaud, John Baldacci, you know, Olympia Snow, a moderate Republican, Bill Cohen. It's a great district. I mean, the only way you lose that seat is you retire or ascend to a higher office, you know, and whether you become a governor or a senator.
If you have good constituent services.
Well, they do excellent, you know, constituent service, and it's a place where people want to see you. But yeah, I think the district is still all those things, but the people are willing to vote the person rather than the party.
I wanted to fit in also, there were a couple of bills that the governor has brought in at the last minute, Dick Woodbury here. One, it would fund Maine nursing homes, which he says are facing closure. The other would pay for this war on drugs, the drug enforcement agents, judges, and prosecutors. Why do these both sort of come out at the 11th hour as emergency legislation instead of being introduced sort of earlier? I should ask the governor, I guess. But what's your take on what's happening there?
Well, I guess I'll begin by agreeing with you that it's really difficult as a legislature to deal with something arriving anew on this one day that we're here and trying to figure out how to handle it. At least one of the bills you mentioned seems as if it is largely incorporated in one of the other bills that has been vetoed. And, you know, so then I think you're getting into the nuances of the governor having vetoed a bill that wasn't quite the way he thought it should be. And so bringing something back that's close to it that is doing it more the way that he wants to. So I have the feeling that at least one and maybe several of the bills you're talking about are in that family.
So a little bit of a statement here in the...
Yeah, I mean, you know, again, I really wish this had been a session where the governor had come to committees early and said, I want to work with you on trying to advance policies in ways that we both can agree on. But that wasn't what happened. It's this veto approach sort of followed by these kinds of last minute bills is more the approach that this governor is using.
Let's go to Rockland and Peter. Hi, Peter.
Hi there. I wanted to, first of all, say thank you for this show and also for MPBN with the Capital Connection. I recently have been kind of tuning in a little more, but still it's kind of new to me and all the politics. But state politics these days, it seems a lot more accessible for just regular people. And I appreciate legislators who make themselves open to hear what people want to tell them. Recently,
we're all regular people.
Recently, I learned about yet another one of these vetoes, and this one, like I say, I'm new to it. I may not quite have it right, but this one was overridden. But it there was a bill that changed the rules for municipalities' street lighting, where they were only able to have streetlights that they rented from CMP, and now, thanks to this bill that was overridden, they can own their own streetlights and save a heck of a lot of money.
And yeah, are you familiar with this?
And my question, though, is if there are any suggestions from people there today how not to be just a real hothead and think certain politicians, like the governor, really have big business. That's their primary person they're serving, and not the people of Maine.
If you all right, Peter,
how not to be a hothead, but also a suggestion of when you know you should be a hothead if somebody really is doing something that is just wrong.
Sure, Peter, we're going to run out of time here, but
go
ahead.
I love the fact that people are passionate in their views, and so. You know, all of us who get into elected office and want to do good things for the state, we're passionate about what we're doing. And, you know, and when in my view, when democracy is working really well, We are passionate, and we're respectful and discussing, and we try to reach a place where there's common understanding, rather than being sort of disrespectful and mean. And there have been times when I've worried that the current environment has gone a little bit over that edge.
And we're over the edge on time. Thank you all for being here. That's what I do. Yeah. Cynthia Dill is a practicing attorney and former Democratic state senator. Dan DeMeritt, political consultant and former communications director for Governor Paul LePage. And Dick Woodbury, an economist and independent Maine state senator representing Yarmouth. Great to have you here again, guys.
Thank you so much.
It's a pleasure.
MPBN's television Maine Capital Connection channel, as Peter, our listener, pointed out, will cover both the Maine House and Senate today, wherever possible. Maine Capital Connection available over the air and on the digital tier of many of Maine's cable companies. For information about the channel, visit mpbn.net. Today's program produced by Jonathan Smith. John Keimel ran the board. We had additional help from the MPBN web team. And you can find past editions of Maine Calling as well as a link to our podcasts by visiting mpbn.net/Maine Calling. I'm Keith Shortall. You've been listening to Maine Calling on the Maine Public Broadcasting Network.